Produced by Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, and Wayne Hall, this is Yes Music Podcast, episode 445. What Did They Do Next? Part 16b, Steve Howe.
Hi, this is Alan White from Yes, and you're listening to Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 445 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine, and co-host, Mark Anthony Kay, will be along a little bit later on. Do please get involved with the podcast yourself via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. This week, Mark and I enjoyed listening to The Grand Scheme of Things by Steve Howe, which he produced shortly after leaving the band following the end of the Union Tour in 1993. It's a great collection, but might be a little bit too long. Take a listen to our thoughts a little later on and add your own to the show notes for this week. On the interwebs this week, and starting with Facebook, Mark posted his latest Project Gemini update. I was surprised to see this is number 111. Preston Frazier added his latest review. This time it's Into the Storm from Fly From Here. And that's one of my favourite songs. Preston likes it as well. Dave Watkinson's book, John Anderson and the Warriors, The Road to Yes, is getting lots of great reviews. And despite some technical challenges, Roger Dean was live again, this time painting the cover of the next Downs Braid Association album. Dave also posted a remarkable newspaper article where Chris Squire is asked by a reader about his stereo or not bass setup. And in the visitor posts, Doug Curran added this. For your information, keyboardist slash composer David Manasian has a new album out in August, The Sound of Dreams. It includes Steve Hackett, Billy Sherwood, Annie Haslam, PJ Olson from the Alan Parsons Project, Julie Raggins from the Moody Blues and Justin Hayward Live, and the drummer Jeff O'Keefe of Pentagram. He's been sent the first two singles, the newest featuring Hackett, a wonderful progressive rock that he highly recommends. Also from Doug was news of the aforementioned DBA album and Jeffrey Mason's contributions included an article on John Anderson, archive documents about that Yes and Peter Frampton JFK concert in 1976, Rick Emmett talking about how Steve Howe was a major influence on him, and ahead of Labour Day, that's a USA thing I understand, news of a vote on Sirius XM Deep Tracks for the most essential progressive rock albums ever made. I don't think you can have most essential, but anyway, select 30 albums from their list. You may vote once between now and August the 21st at noon. So, there you go. Miguel Falcao added a notification that he's on this very episode, so listen out for that in a minute. And Doug Curran was back posting his brilliant signed test pressings of Rick Wakeman's latest offering, The Red Planet. Priceless. Bob Martellotta added Rachel Flowers' article on Chris Squire's Fish Out of Water. And over on Twitter, there was a very amusing flurry of tweets on the topic of Yes stage fashions, which resulted in the suggestion from ForgottenYesterday.com's Brian Sullivan that we do some sort of YMP episodes on that subject. Well, maybe. I added a photo of the full Union postal tube, which I attempted to send to Canada. Unfortunately, the post office managed to send it to the return address. That is, back to me, rather than to the recipient, despite the fact that I paid the correct transatlantic costs. Brilliant job. The Progressive Palaver podcast are ranking Yes songs on their show on Sunday. So that could be a car crash. And Jim Halley, former Yes tour coordinator, continued to post amazing photos of the band from his own personal collection. Wow, there are some remarkable things there. So as always, many thanks indeed to everyone who has been in touch in any way this week, including the commenters on last week's show notes, Simon Barrow, Jules, Miguel Falcao, Doug Curran, G. Kevin Gilroy, H.B. Peterson, and Dave Watkinson. And speaking of Miguel, so I'm delighted to welcome Miguel Falcao back onto the YMP this week. Hello, Miguel.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for having me again on the show. And thank you for Yes Music Podcast to have become my patron. And it's very, very kind of you.
Well, the stuff you do is great, keeping the memory of Chris Squire alive. And this year we've reached Play for Chris 6. So that's 6 years. It's amazing to think that. For those who don't know about it yet, what was the original idea behind the Play for Chris project?
in 2015 when Chris became ill, we decided, suggested by an idea of our friend Devin Flatow, to make a kind of a get well message to Chris. So I gathered all the people that were fans of Chris's, and then we just had a kind of 1 minute clip for each participant, and to play something from Chris's catalog, and to send a message to him. Then we all knew that that Chris had passed away, but still the video was shown to him, and so, you know, that's hardly a compensation, but that's the way it happened.
Yes, indeed. So I've taken part myself each year, each part of the
that's true
1 to 5, and also this year. But this year, it's slightly different, isn't it? I mean, I actually started off by just appearing on camera and saying something, but then I even learnt the bass guitar so that I could take part in this fantastic tribute to Chris a bit more fully. But tell us about this year. Something's changed this year, and how did that come about?
Yes, Stephen Sullivan, who you may know from Forgotten Yesterdays, he's a bass player, a great bass player, and a longtime friend from the old days of Alt Music Yes newsgroups.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he suggested to me something that actually Devin also had spoken to me about, which was to make a version of The Fish, being The Fish, perhaps one of the most symbolic songs from Chris's and his solo spot, usual solo spot, where we usually were delighted to see him play live. Why didn't we make something like a new version of the fish with all people playing the parts? So as you know, The Fish is a multi-track bass song, so it has several melodies and themes going on in a kind of loop, and also with some percussion and vocals. But I made a map of all the themes that happen during the song, and organized them as slots, what I called slots. And each of the participants had a list with a description and some technical musical stuff for helping them to play the parts. And then I would gather each of the slots from, some participants played all the slots, and some of them just one or two.
Yes.
But then I had, I had already to start with like a bass orchestra, and I could mix in and out, recreate a little bit of the atmosphere of, I think, what Yes Music also did very often, which was to make this kind of collage of several bits and pieces of music to make a kind of a big sounding, which I didn't think it would be so big at the beginning. But then as other instruments became available, I started to think, so maybe I should add this wind instrument, or maybe this percussion would be. And then I would start to contact some of my friends, right, and other friends that I knew they played different instruments, to make a kind of a, orchestral version of The Fish.
Right, fantastic. So they've all done videos as well, is that right?
Everyone has made a separate video and audio for each of the part that they played. So in some cases, as I got a little bit more excited about the project, and as you know, The Fish is a song which is basically modal, and I started to think, well, if I keep the modal character all throughout the song, maybe it needs a little bit of development. And so I started to add new instruments which provide more dynamics that will you know, we'll make the song breathe a little more because it's longer. And also adding some variations to the themes, something that, you know, not even the players that play the parts, they know about that. And hopefully they will be pleasantly surprised when they see the parts they have played may sometimes change the context and create something that, you know, it would be like my dream of making Yes music.
Right.
And fantastic. I hope that the listeners also will get this feeling that, the you know, that there is something from each participant's heart. And some of them, they really didn't know Chris before because I contacted them. Others are longtime fans. There are many different kinds of involvement of the participants, many different kinds of experience, musical experience, and, you know, but they are all united. And even those who didn't know so well Chris Squire now may be, you know, more tempted to know more about Yes Music and Chris.
Brilliant. Well, that's a fantastic thing. And, of course, we've seen quite a few of these remote collaborations during this lockdown time that we've had. But how many musicians overall have taken part?
We have 45 musicians. This is really the largest participation in any Play for Chris. Of course,
yeah,
it contributed also that I made more advertisement, and also that, as I told you before, as I was getting excited about the project and trying to make something really different and new to the song, then I started, you know, on purpose, like inviting friends that I knew they played some different instruments to make a, you know, an arrangement or something. So we have 45, and I'm just waiting for one very special contributor to deliver the video, so I can definitely close the final edit.
Yes. And that's me you're talking about, because I haven't done my video yet, but I'll do that for today and send it over to you. So tell us about when it's going to be released, the video, and where we'll be able to watch it.
So it will be released on my Miguel based channel. That's on YouTube. And my plan is to release it on our time, which is, you know, British summertime and Portuguese time. It will be at 11:59, so 1 minute right. To midnight, to midnight, yeah. Of next Saturday. So that's tomorrow for those who are listening.
Yes.
On Friday. So I will try to, you know, to post the premiere link in my Facebook and all other social media pages that I have. So it will be Saturday evening, and for, you know, for the those in the other side of the Atlantic, it will be in the afternoon, and you know, and for the other ones more to the east, it will be already on the Sunday, but it's it's like Saturday evening.
Yes, absolutely. That's fantastic. I'm really looking forward to hearing and seeing the end product, and as we said, just keep your eyes peeled and you might see me for a few seconds in there as well, and hear my bass guitar in the mix. You never know.
I will be generous for you.
Thank you very much indeed, Miguel. It's great to speak to you again.
All right. Thank you very much, Kevin, and see you on Saturday evening. And let's all celebrate Chris and with Play for Chris 6, The Fish.
I've an All Yes Music podcast every week. I love to hear what Kevin says. I've an All Yes Music podcast every week. I love to hear what Kevin says.
Before I have a listen to the grand scheme of things, here's Simon Barrow.
Hi, Kevin and Mark. Simon Barrow here. Thanks for another great episode on Steve Howe, and really looking forward to your comments on the grand scheme of things. Don't forget Turbulence either, which obviously had a big influence on Union, amongst other things. Fantastic instrumental album from Steve. It was really great also that you mentioned Artistry, the album by Martin Taylor that Steve produced. They've been friends for a long time. Martin, of course, is, well, a world-class guitarist, incredibly well-known in the jazz world. Extraordinary technique. That particular album is a great take on jazz standards and the Great American Songbook. In fact, I bumped into Martin twice in 1997. Once was at a solo Steve gig, and the other time was the Open Your Eyes Yes tour when it arrived in Glasgow. Probably not many jazz heads at a Yes concert, so I recognised Martin, had a bit of a chat with him. He's a great admirer of Steve's work, and they collaborated on another really important album called Masterpiece Guitars in 2002, which was based on the Scott Chinnery collection of very unusual and precious guitars that they're the amongst the very few people to be allowed to touch ever. Sadly, Scott passed away a few years ago, but that album is a true testament. Some solo Steve tracks, quite a number of solo Martin tracks, and a few where they collaborated together. I guess the difference is that Martin very much focuses in the jazz area. His technique is simply stunning. I mean, on Artistry, it's not just double stopping, it's almost treble stopping with his technique. A lot of people thought overdubs were used, but they weren't on that. Steve, on the other hand, is a kind of complete guitarist who can adopt to so many different styles and genres. He can use classical and jazz, rock, blues, bits of bluegrass, country, you name it, he's adopted it, even the Koto from Japan. If you took any of those areas, you would find practitioners who are technically a bit better than him, but that really isn't the point. It's the way that he's able to utilize the guitar in so many different ways, has developed his own distinctive style and tone and texture and color, and he's quite remarkable. At 73 years of age, he can still produce Love Is, which is a really good album, again quite different from other stuff he's done in the past. But do check out Martin Taylor more. It really, really is worthwhile. Okay, take care, y'all. Bye.
Despite the lofty-sounding name, the title track of The Grand Scheme of Things isn't grandiose in feel at the beginning. In fact, it's restrained with quiet bass line and picked electric guitar in octaves at times, playing a jazzy and articulate line. There's a change to a more rock orientation, with some great string bending and wailing rock soloing. Howe adds vocals in his inimitable style, and it's an interesting concoction. It does now have a bit of an air of important themes. There's good harmony choral singing, and the various guitar parts fit in well. A bit of fretless-sounding bass accompanies more verses, and the refrain, which repeats the title several times, is catchy. Overall, it's fairly laid-back, despite some more insistent keyboard brass fanfares, but I think it's an effective curtain-raiser, and of course the guitar playing is superb. More heroic-style electric soloing, seemingly at a distance, brings us to the end of the song, via a mini-breakdown of instruments. An interesting an encouraging opening. Next we have Desire Comes First. This opens with a keyboard rasp and then a country and western tinged guitar. As I'm perhaps coming to expect from Howe, this is quickly taken over by a different sound, with grungy electric and acoustic strumming beneath a glorious electric solo. A touch of Wakeman sounding organ work brings in another feel, which has walking bass and a lot more high and fairly screeching electric, until that country and western picking is back, but only for a few seconds. These textures and approaches end up being a bit of a tapestry which morphs into something like Mike Oldfield for a time, with a lovely violin solo passage or two. Bass is omnipresent and keeps everything rooted well. Another interesting piece. Then we're on to Blinded by Science. This is an upbeat, jaunty little number with plenty of sunshine-infused guitars flitting pleasingly around a poppy drum figure. Steve sings again on this one with some backup singing as well. Another catchy and head-nodding song adorned with high-pitched Howe electric soloing, a lot of it crafted to provide counter-melodic interest. This song also features some elaborate guitar orchestra moments. What fun! Beautiful Ideas is an acoustic treasure with the addition of some appropriate keys, and then a vocal line again from Steve himself. I thought this was going to be a mood-for-the-day type acoustic number, but it develops into a slow-paced, light rock band song instead. That theme of starting in one mode and then making a dramatic change is here again. Singing is rather good, actually, and the song is beautifully constructed. Some fine songwriting with lots going on in the arrangement. Suddenly a new faster and frenetic feel appears and the music is ramped up in an exciting manner. There's a collection of fast house-style runs and some dramatic drumming before an abrupt end. Interesting stuff. Ah, The Valley of Rocks is the solo acoustic piece, I think. This is very fast and reminiscent of Clap in Places. It shows off the picking style of Mr. Howe we all love so much. A lovely little palate cleanser with American-sounding elements, as well as maybe a bit of Spanish. There's a terrifically fast passage, which sounds like it's going to lead to the end of the piece, but Steve sets off again, reprising some of the soundscape of earlier. There's no doubt this is a Howe guitar solo, and I wasn't surprised to see on ForgottenYesterdays.com that Steve played this 17 times at Yes concerts between 1997 and 2012. Very enjoyable. Next we find Steve at the gates of the new world. Dramatic keyboard chords alternate with acoustic guitar and then the song kicks in properly. The chorus is breathtaking in its breadth and the verse provides a fun counterpoint. Steve's singing is once again really good, and like Love Is on his newest album, this one is very catchy indeed. This is the kind of expansiveness I was hoping for in Heaven and Earth, for example. It's not a progressive masterwork, but the way the chorus emerges from the other material is spine-tingling, and the bass climbs out of the texture in much the way Chris Squire's line would have done, I suspect. The mood ramps up again before a peaceful finish with quiet figures on a broad range of different guitars. Great stuff. Wayward Course comes next. Another solo acoustic opening, this is a finely crafted introduction to a section with a big backbeat and repeated acoustic licks over the top. The Spanish-sounding guitar reappears and then a bit of a vamp is set up with some keyboards in the mix. The sections seem a bit fragmented and the whole thing comes to a standstill with echoing electric guitar notes and spacey electronic sounds. It's interesting, but odd. Then there's a guitar sounding almost exactly like a harpsichord, and it's not clear where the music's going. The band kick in again and it's all a bit difficult to follow, but still enjoyable. There might be a few too many ideas thrown into this melting pot, perhaps. Reaching the Point is the first co-authored piece, this time with vocalist Keith West, and it starts with warped-sounding tape loops in a total departure from everything else. Wah guitar is added before a bit of an MOR feel begins. It's suddenly not as interesting as it was. There's some pretty good vocals from Howe and decent harmony backing, but it's a bit of a shame that the initial feel was abandoned. It's a good song, though, with some effective solo piano in a middle section and a few 90s music technology nods, but it's not one I'll remember in the same way as At the Gates of the New World, for example. At least the ending has some improvised drum soloing, which is fun. Common Ground is written by Steve and late son Virgil. The opening acoustic or Spanish guitar, I'm never quite sure which it is a bit reminiscent of parts of Tales, and Virgil's piano accompaniment is lovely. It's refreshing to hear just piano and guitar here, and it's a beautiful, lilting, melodic piece. It does remind me of the duo's fantastic album Nexus, and I could listen to this kind of music for hours on end. Sadly, though, it's only 2 minutes and 18 seconds long. Luck of the Draw is even shorter, 1 minute and 43 seconds. This is a Steve solo creation in an American Western style. Steve plays the dobro, I think, to the accompaniment of a committed band, and it's a lot of fun. I can picture the swinging doors of a saloon, but all I know about the Wild West comes from the TV, so that's my extreme prejudice there. Next up is The Fall of Civilization. Blimey, Howe is going for it in the titles. This one's penned by Janet Howe, Steve Howe, and West, as it puts it. I imagine it's the lyrics by Janet, although I can't be sure. Some synth strings start and Howe sings a verse tinged with sadness. The theme of the end of times and war is made more poignant by the addition of violin and fine guitar work, as we'd expect. There's a lot more hope in the lyrics later on, and a rock number appears, as if from nowhere. It's very interesting stuff, and there's even a Spanish guitar solo, reminiscent of the passage Steve added to Queen's Innuendo, at least in tone if not structure. Fast-paced electric soloing is a treat, and the rock stomp is great fun. Effective use of contract in this one, and more pretty decent singing. A quiet end finishes off this satisfying song. Passing Phase has strummed acoustic guitars with a remarkable sliding steel solo over the top. If you like Howe's steel in Yes, then here's a chance to hear a lot more of it. The music skips through different genres with Italian-sounding mandolin and Spanish-sounding bolero elements all thrown in at each other. Once again, it's a fascinating mix if you can cope with all the battling elements, which jostle in the 3.5 minutes. George's Theme is another piece which has been played live at Yes concerts, just 3 times though, between 1998 and 2009. A solo piece again, when he played it alongside Leaves of Green in Georgia. Appropriately, in August 2002, he said, "That little tune that I wrote for my eldest daughter, who's 20, and her name's Georgia, so it's called George's Theme." How appropriate. It's a tender, subtle opening with repeated themes. Bass is in the mix as well in this version, which gives a lot of depth to the sound, and there are a few touches of keyboards as well, doubling the theme and then expanding out into washes of sound. The piece broadens out, but then returns to the opening material again. An appropriately simple structure, but with the added interest of that keyboard and bass work, it's a decent diversion, if not groundbreaking. Too Much Is Taken and Not Enough Given begins with some The Edge-type guitar sounds, but when Steve sings, it carries on very unlike U2. Plenty of soaring solo electric is a good counterpoint to the low and calm vocals. A great mobile bass line accompanies a more up-tempo section, and many different guitars thrown in. It's a well-constructed song with some interesting and odd timing in some sections, deliberately meant to be unsettling, I would imagine, as the name of the song is repeated. The lyrics stray to cliché and banality at times, unfortunately, but the guitar, orchestra and fabulous playing make up for that. A static bass line accompanies some frenetic solo electric, and the song ends with a slightly bizarre shift to picked solo acoustic guitar. Again, there's a lot in this song. The penultimate piece is Maiden Voyage. This is certainly dramatic. Big chords on keyboards start, after which a medium-paced rocky beat is set up for Steve's various guitars to solo over the top. The guitar line sounds very vocal-inspired. He's making it sing for a time, and then the mood is broken to rebuild in a head-nodding, toe-tapping manner. Further changes in timing and feel keep you on your toes, and it all skips along. Not the most memorable piece on the record for me, but certainly worth a listen. And finally we reach Road to Oneself. There's a koto here, I think, and a wooden flute. It's a very interesting sound combination, sometimes playing in unison, sometimes weaving in and out. I've no idea how close this is to the structures and aesthetics of Japanese music, but I like it very much. It does feel a bit random to include this as the last piece on this album, when there's nothing anything like it anywhere else. But whatever the reason, I'm glad it's here. So, a lot of shorter pieces, but a long album. In fact, to get anything approaching a handle on it, I think it needs many listens. There's a lot of very interesting and rewarding music here, and some which could do with some editing, perhaps, with too many ideas shoehorned in for me. But overall, I think this is really good stuff. Perhaps the flute, bass, and other guesting instruments and vocals could have been used a bit more, but that's a minor concern. As with 2020's Love Is, if you like Steve Howe's playing, then this is a big collection of his best approaches.
Greetings, friends, and we're back again this week to continue our very popular What Did They Do Next series, and this week we are doing part 2 of Steve Howe's The Grand Scheme of Things. Before I start, I just wanted to thank everybody for all the kind words and support for the episode we did last week with Casey Young. We really appreciate it. It was a really fantastic interview. Anyways, let's get on with part 2 of Steve Howe and the Grand Scheme of Things. Before I get started about my thoughts about it, let's go through some of the, you know, basic information about it. This album came out August 24th, 1993, which is getting pretty close to the date, actually, today being August 11th for me. It was released on Relativity Records, and the record is about 58 minutes long and was produced by Steve Howe himself. I had mentioned in the first part of this that I hadn't listened very much to this record, and that was very true. When I put this record on and took a listen to it, I realized how much I didn't remember of this record and was pleasantly surprised about how good it was. Not to say that I don't think Steve Howe records are good, but having heard my opinions of his earlier catalog, musically I've always thought of him as very strong, but it was always the vocals that sort of turned me off on some of his earlier recordings. I'll just start by saying that this record has very pleasantly surprised me, at least on the vocal end of things, some of his finer vocals, I think, are on this record. Of course, like usual, I'm going to leave all the song-by-song-by-song detailing to Kevin, who is very good at that sort of thing. But I'm just going to give you some of my thoughts, and I will pick out a few songs from this record to look into a little bit more detail. So the record starts off with The Grand Scheme of Things. Now, the interesting thing about this record is that, again, it's one of these albums that is divided up into songs with vocals and instrumental songs, very much like even his most current record, Love Is, which is a complete 50-50. Now, this album is not a 50-50. There is 7 vocal songs and 9 instrumental songs. So there are 16 songs. And that was the first thing that kind of struck me about this record. When I first looked at it, I was like, 16 songs? Wow, how long is this record? And I was pleasantly surprised to realize that it was under an hour. So yes, you can have an album with many songs on it, and it doesn't need to be 74 minutes long. So the album starts off with The Grand Scheme of Things. And right away, I really liked the vibe of this album. There's some good singing on this right off the bat, which really surprised me, as I said earlier. Either he had taken some lessons, maybe, or maybe he's just gotten to be a better singer by that point. But another thing that kind of struck me was they were fresh off of doing the Union tour, probably, at this point. And, you know, that was a pretty lengthy tour. And when you go out and tour for that period of time, and having to sing as much as he had to do, considering that it was even just backing vocals, one's vocals become much stronger overall. So maybe he was just in fine form to be singing at this point. And the songs really, really benefited from that. The next song, Desire Comes First, has some fantastic guitar playing again and some really, really strong bass playing by Nick Beggs, who's known as a fantastic bass player, obviously. Another thing that kind of struck me about this song is the guitar tone for Steve, because usually Steve likes to play with a much more cleaner toned guitar tone, but on this song he seems to have a bit more of a heavier distorted sound on it, which really suits the song itself. So I'm glad to see that he wasn't totally against using those types of tones on his records. There's also some nice violin work here by Anna Palm, who I think really complimented his soloing. They went back and forth nicely on some solo sections, and I think that her playing really complimented Steve's guitar playing overall. Now, Blinded by Science was up next, and I remember when I first saw this title, I was scratching my head and thinking, he couldn't possibly have done a Thomas Dolby cover, right? And it wasn't. It was his song completely. And I have to say, I really enjoyed this. It's very upbeat. It has some very good lead work at the very beginning. The acoustic guitar work is fantastic. Now, his lead vocals are good. Not as strong as some of the songs prior to this, but the vocal harmonies that he comes up with in this song are very, very well done. And the production of the song is very nicely done. I like some of the treatment of the, the sounds, some of the reverbs he uses and stuff like that. It's very well thought out, and the sound of the song overall is very pleasing to the ear, I find, at least to my ears. So I have to give him some props for that. Now, again, as I mentioned earlier, I've been very surprised by the singing on this album, and there's many examples of this strong singing throughout the album. I mean, one song that definitely surprised me very much to the point of where I completely stopped what I was doing and just took a seat and listened was Too Much Is Taken and Not Enough Given. I thought this was very well done, and it had a very interesting mood to it, I found, overall, the production of it. Now, what I mean by that is that this album sounds very much like the kind of albums that were coming out from Relativity Records at this time. I was a big fan of the label itself. It had people, like those kind of like Joe Satriani, Steve Vai type virtuoso musicians on there, so Steve Howe obviously fit in. But what I kind of noticed is, compared to some of his other records, he definitely has a little bit more flash to his lead playing. The singing is much better, but overall the production of it has a little bit more of a darker edge to it, I find. And a lot of the Relativity records around that time had that sound to it, where it had a lot of dark reverbs and kind of soaked in, and his vocals were not so upfront. They kind of pulled them back into the music. Even when he did his acoustic guitar playing, they are a lot wetter than the normal times he would record. Like when I think back to the Steve Howe album, for example, a lot of his acoustic guitar playing on that was very dry. Not dry as in performance, but dry as in sounding, right? So I think that Relativity might have had some influence on the overall tonality of this record, and I think it was an obvious plus. in my opinion, because I like I said, I loved those records, and to have Steve do a record with that sort of approach, I think was fantastic. The last song I'm going to mention on here that really spoke to me, I guess it would be a good word to say, is George's Theme. Now, this is a song that I was familiar with, you know, for a long time, because he would use this piece sometimes in his solo pieces that he would do in concert. And I always love it when Steve has a solo piece like this on his album. I kind of look at Steve and acoustic guitar like how Rick Wakeman and the piano are. It is their strongest instrument. So Steve and a classical or an acoustic guitar are like a match made in musical heaven. I very much think that. While he's been known for his electric guitar work, I really think that where the magic lies in Steve Howe's playing is when he is given an acoustic guitar or a classical guitar. He's almost a one-man band in that sense, and it's something that I'm not very good at, so I'm always sort of envious of his style of guitar playing when it comes to classical or acoustic guitar playing. So those are my thoughts on the grand scheme of things. Overall, I say it's probably one of his stronger records I've run across, to be quite honest, and I've been listening to it quite a bit, actually, the last little while, and I think I'll continue to be listening to it, because while I like the songs as well, and I think the singing is just really, really well done, the overall sound of this record is something that really speaks to me. And I think that if you like those types of records that came out around this period that had those kind of sounds to it, this record is for you. So let's go over to Kevin and talk about this record some more.
Steve Howe tells us about the grand scheme of things, and Mark joins me now. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. How are you doing today?
I'm okay. I'm absolutely sweltering. It's incredibly hot in the UK at the moment. What about you?
Yeah, it's pretty hot over here too. They were promising us a break from the heat a little bit, but like usual with the weathermen here, they were incorrect.
Excellent. Okay. Isn't that lovely? Oh, they're always wrong, aren't they? All right, then. So Steve Howe, this is what he did next after leaving the Union Tour. And as we said last week, and I think you mentioned, he went straight into creating this album, which he produced himself. And vocals, apart from a couple of places maybe, you pointed out, and I mentioned as well, surprisingly good on this. And I liked your idea of perhaps he was in good shape vocally after the Union Tour. He'd had a lot of practice and very warmed up. So yeah, some good vocals on this.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was one of the things that really took me aback. Like I said, I hadn't listened to this record for quite a while. And for the last while now, I've been listening to it quite a lot, actually. This album's really impressed me. I really, really enjoyed it, and I think it's probably one of Steve's better vocal performances, actually.
Yeah. 16 songs, 58 minutes. That's a lot of material. Is it? Do you ever feel like me that I mean, we've talked in the past about albums being too long, that this is too long, and it's, you know, it takes so many listens through to get a handle on each one of the songs?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's one of the reasons why, even with my own records and all the records that I kind of enjoy from other bands, I find that that 40 to 45 minute range is usually best, because like you said, it's hard to absorb 60 minutes of music, let alone like 74 minutes that some bands do nowadays. You know, like, how can you remember, you know, what happened, like, you know, 60 minutes into a record? You know, I mean, it's just too much. You know, I think you're better off just taking your strongest songs and, you know, releasing that. I mean, one of the things I'd love to see, and I think maybe it might be a cool thing for the listeners to do, is listen to this record and pick 8 songs and make your own version of this record from the songs that you think are the best 8 from it. I think it would be a totally different listen, and it might actually be an even stronger record for that.
Yeah, I think so, because there were some there as I went through and I thought, you know, this is good music, it's beautifully performed and played really well, but it didn't grab me on the first listen anyway. But, well, yeah, so do that. If you think you've got a great alternative version of this album with just 8 of the songs, then let us know. And then perhaps it would have given them a chance to expand some of them. Some I felt finished a little bit prematurely. And I liked your comments about the violin. I agree with you about that. And we spoke to David Cross, so quite some time ago now, about his work in King Crimson and with Peter Banks. And I think, as you said, the violin fits in rather well here and some of the other instruments. But I would have liked to have heard more of that. And particularly, what did you think of that last piece with the koto and the what sounds like a wooden flute?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely something that you don't expect to hear from Steve Howe solo records. But that's, I think, maybe just one of those things that I kind of enjoyed about this record was that it at least made it something memorable. Because like you said, you're in 16 songs in, and then, you know, you get to that and it's like, whoa, it suddenly joggles your mind for a minute. Like, this is something completely different, because there's a lot of acoustic guitar in this record. There's a lot of, you know, typical, I'm not going to say typical, that sounds harsh, a sort of trademark Steve Howe things on here. And, you know, you sometimes have a hard time remembering, was that on this song or was that on that song, because there's so much music. But it's really well done. And I think that, you know, if he would have cut the record a bit shorter, it would have been much stronger. Because, I mean, for example, song 14, Too Much Is Taken and Not Enough Given, is a really good song.
Yes.
But I think it's way too far down the list. You know, it should have been brought up more, you know, higher up on the track listing, I thought.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And I think there's some really, as you say, strong and great songs, perhaps slightly hidden in there. And I would have liked to have seen that koto a bit earlier as well. And, you know, maybe inside, you know, after an acoustic guitar number, then you could have had that and then go back to the rockier style, etc. But, you know, maybe perhaps I'll do my own playlist of that. I was interested to hear what you said about his guitar approach as well. And I noticed that there were quite a few of those heavier, distorted sounds coming out there. Certainly, probably a few more than his latest album Love Is, which is a bit more of a peaceful and you know, based on love, of course. so some different and darker material on this, perhaps, although it never gets particularly dark. And I was interested in this idea of yours about relativity, and there was a kind of 90s sound to that label. What do you think that was about? Did the artists talk to each other? Was it just something which happened by osmosis, or what was going on?
Well, I mean, the funny thing is, during that time period, I found production changed. Like, during the later 2000s, for example, bands got back to like this really upfront, dominant bass drum sound that had a really loud click to it, like da-da-da-da-da. It was really upfront. Yeah. But in this time period, if you notice, a lot of the bands that put out albums, even not on Relativity even, but like in general, the snare drum was very upfront in the mix a lot. And I mean, and this record too, the snare drum is mixed really out front on his songs. And I found that it's very interesting, because that whole record, to me, sounds very 90-ish. It has a lot of verb on it. It has a lot of dark-sounding reverbs. It has that whole mood to it is a little bit more darker than we expect from a Steve Howe record, I think, right? And I just think that it was one of those time periods where, you know, I think that Steve was kind of smart to do it, because if he wanted to stay current and you know, and like relative to the times, he had to kind of do that. It would have sounded odd if he put a totally 70s-sounding album out at that time period. It would have been like a sore thumb, you know? I think that he did a good job with that approach. And for some of the songs, I think it worked nicely. I mean, some of the acoustic guitar pieces that he did, having that little bit more, you know, kind of mysterious verb to it and stuff like that, might have actually helped in the feel of this music.
Yeah, yeah, I think it definitely did. And we've spoken before about people saying that, and I'm sure it is the case, that Steve's live sound has got cleaner and cleaner over the years. So this is a bit different and therefore a little bit interesting.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, as time went on, Steve's guitar sound cleaned up quite a bit. And I think that's maybe because as they started going through the, you know, the reforming of Yes and stuff like that, he probably wanted to go back to some of his more tones that he was used to back in the day. And I think that, you know, at this time, I think he was very much wanting to be like current. I don't think that he was, you know, looking back. I think he was looking very much forward at this time period as far as the sound and the production and everything.
Yeah, it'd be fascinating to take a look at that, wouldn't it, from those earliest days. And you know, having to play some of those early Yes songs in a manner approaching what Peter Banks did on the original versions. So that was one of his jobs when he first came into the band, of course, was to replicate but certainly play in something like the style of the previous guitarist, because otherwise people coming to the shows would have not understood what was going on, I suppose, if he started playing completely differently. And then very, very clean and sometimes not. And then you've got something like Relayer, which was a different style again, as we've talked about it, with the use of the Telecaster rather than other guitars that he's favoured. And then I suppose you could talk about, you know, spool forward to something like Drama, and then on into his Asia years, and a very different approach there, wasn't there? I mean, that was perhaps the height of a very different kind of Steve Howe sound with Asia.
Oh, definitely. I mean, that's where I think he kind of embraced more of a slightly more distorted guitar sound. Mm. It sounded very much more current with that time. And I think that was not only his decision, but I was very positive it had a lot to do with the producer, because I'm sure he looked at them and said, listen, if you guys want to put out a record that's going to be a big hit radio-wise and stuff like that, you have to sound like what's kind of floating around now. Mm, and a clean, jangly, you know, Gibson 152 sound is not going to cut it right now. You have to put something a little bit more with some hair on it. And they did, and it sounded great, you know?
Yes, that's right. And I liked, just taking that a little step further, I liked what you said about George's theme, which is a lovely, lovely piece of music and shows off his acoustic and classical guitar work. And you said that, like Wakeman's piano, you know, perhaps it's his best work is on those types of instruments. And it reminded me of someone completely different. So again, not that, well, very shortly before this record, he was on stage with Trevor Rabin in the Union tour. And Rabin, of course, used a solo acoustic guitar on Solly's Beard, which was his very, very different type of guitar solo piece to what Steve was doing on stage. So I'd be interested to hear what your thoughts are and the difference between Rabin's solo acoustic and Steve's solo acoustic work.
Well, what I think the main difference is that Steve Howe is like a four-piece band in one when it comes to playing acoustic, because he can write such pieces, it sounds like more than one person playing. They're so elaborate. Yeah, you know, he does all these low, you know, running lines on one part of it, and then he's doing these melodic lines on top. It's like, it's just amazing what he can do on songs like, you know, The Clap and all of his pieces that he does. Yeah. They're very well done, you know, like even like The Ancient and stuff like that. Mm. You know, those kind of things, they're very well written. Whereas Trevor Rabin, I think, more approaches his pieces like he's doing like lead guitar work, but on a classical guitar.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because if you notice all his solos, they're never him doing like chord structures and stuff like that, like, you know, like Mood for a Day, where he has like, you know, there's lots of chords and lots of, you know, little runs in between the chording. With him, it's just like, okay, Tony, here's five chords that I want you to play, you know, in straight 4/4 time, and I'm just going to solo over on top of it.
Yeah.
You know?
And
that's the main difference, you know?
Yeah. And I do love that solo that he does on the Union concert. But that was exactly what I was thinking when I was asking you the question, was that those patterns that he goes in for, they do, you know, substitute his electric guitar for the acoustic guitar there, and he would perhaps be playing something rather similar. So it's very different, and I suppose in a way, Steve's guitar playing is wider and different. I won't say wider, because of course we know that some of Rabin's acoustic guitar work is absolutely brilliant. But then I was thinking about the other Yes musicians through the years, and thinking about, do they have a particular style of instrument which seems to suit their style best? And Bill Bruford, we've talked about before, his dalliance with electric percussion, but we do think that his acoustic work much better. But then you have someone like Chris Squire, of course, and he is synonymous with electric bass. There are occasions where he's played acoustic bass, for example, on the Yes Acoustic stuff, and when they did a little a little section in the Yes live concerts, one of which I saw, which was the acoustic with the piano and the Steve Howe playing his acoustic guitar and a string acoustic bass for Chris Squire, but very much the electric. And then Peter Banks, I thought again, although we know he plays wonderful acoustic classical style guitar, he is really again synonymous with that electric sound, and Kay synonymous with Hammond, although we know he's very good at piano. But it's interesting, isn't it, that when you start going through them, what are their trademark instruments? And I suppose of all of those, Steve Howe encompasses everything.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing that's funny, I like how you kind of brought up this point, because if you would dig even deeper to it, I would go so far as to say, like, Bill Bruford, I think that one of his trademark things is his snare drum sound. Yeah, like, when you hear him playing that pong that he plays with, yes, it's very much Bill Bruford, you know? And with Chris Squire, when I think of Chris Squire, that Rickenbacker sound is what I think, because, you know, he also uses that jazz bass. He also uses that green one that has that CS initial on it, you know? And those are, and even that bass that he uses in drama that has that flanging effect and stuff like that on it. But whenever I think of him, I can't help but think of that Rickenbacker sound. So, I mean, it is interesting how they each have their sort of identifiable instrument. Like Rick Wakeman, I think piano, but most some people would say, no, it's Moog that they would identify with him. But, you know, Tony Kaye, obviously Hammond organ.
Yeah. It's fascinating, isn't it, to see who is. And then you move further out to people like John Davison and Billy Sherwood. Fascinating, because what would you associate Billy Sherwood with? Well, if you're a Yes fan, you'd probably associate him with bass now, but that wasn't always the case, and he's a fantastic multi-instrumentalist. And again, it depends when you're talking about with someone like John Davison, and maybe that's why they fit into the band so well, is that they are masters of very different instruments, because originally didn't John Davison start playing the bass and also plays guitar very, very well, and sings. So, you know, as I say, that's possibly why they fit in so well, because they are masters of different instruments.
Yeah, and what's interesting about that point that you brought up is that because they can do so many different things, I think on one hand, though, that also gives them a disadvantage, because they don't have that identifiable something. You know what I mean? Whereas if you have Chris Squire or if you have Tony Kaye, when you remove those people from the band, that's missing from it. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so when you have a Billy Sherwood, and sure, great, he can cover the guitar, he can cover singing, he can cover all kinds of things, but he doesn't have that, well, maybe not yet, maybe that'll come still, but maybe he doesn't have that one thing where you say, when I think of Billy Sherwood, I think of this. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And John Davison, he's a great singer, and he's a great acoustic guitar player as well, and he plays bass obviously well, but all these things, there isn't one thing that has his stamp, although I would say that his singing is very much becoming, to me now, his signature. Like, when I hear him singing now on some of these tribute records and stuff like that that he helps out with, I know now right away it's John Davison.
Yeah, that's right, and that's what he seems to be sought out for, I suppose, because being the Yes frontman, the Yes singer, people will want that on their records, that voice and that ability. But of course, having said that, when we talked about Love Is, he plays bass on that and does backing singing. so absolutely fascinating stuff. Okay, well, yes, I've really enjoyed that record. Possibly I would cut it down, if it was me, to, as you said, 8. So send us in your 8 songs from that record that you think would make a nice collection of songs from that record. And also let us know what you think about the different Yes musicians that we've just touched on there. When you think of a Yes musician, what is it that you think of? What instrument, what role within the band or within music more generally? And put your comments and questions on the show notes for this week. For the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
This is Miguel Falcón at miguelbass.com. You are listening to the Yes Music Podcast. Established in 2011, This is Two Fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band.
Just before we go, here's Patreon update. Yes Music Podcast producers are Jeffrey Grisselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier and Wayne Hall. And half of the Yes Music Podcast patrons are Aaron Steelman, Bob Martellotta, Brian Sullivan, Chris Bandini, Craig Estenes, Dave Owen, David Hayden, Lind, David Pannell, David Watkinson, Dem, Doug Curran, Fergus Cubbage, Fred Barringer, Jeff Bailey, Jeffrey Mason, Guy de Rome, Henrik Antonsen, H.B. Peterson, Ian M.B., Jamie McQuinn, Ken Fuller, Michael Handahan, Jim, John Cowan, John Holden, John Parry, John Thompson, and Barry Gorski. Robert and David, thanks to you as well. So many thanks indeed to all those patrons. If you'd like to join them to keep the lights on here at YMP Towers, then please do. Just go to Patreon, patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast for all the details. Otherwise, just click the Patreon link on any of the show notes on yesmusicpodcast.com. So that's just about all the time we have this week. Next week, I've got a couple of days off work, so there may or may not be an episode. We'll keep you posted. However, in the meantime, do please keep listening and getting involved via Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. So until next time, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.